This is Gully Canoe. St. Francis and the Sow. The bud stands for all things, even those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing, though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow, to put a hand on its brow of the flower, and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely, until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. As St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow, and told her in words and in touch, blessings of earth on the sow, and the sow began remembering all down her thick length, from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine, down through the great broken heart, to the blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering from the 14 teats into the 14 mouths sucking and blowing beneath them, the long, perfect loveliness of sow. So I've been working on this series, Many Musics, for a couple of years now, and I'm up to the fifth series of them. Each series is 60 poems long. So when I start a new series of poems, I like to have an epigraph at the beginning, and he's just talking about the nature of things, and he says the following. He says, I believe that the truth of the matter is far more terrifying, that the real truth that dare not speak its name is that no one is in control, absolutely no one. There is an hour between, maybe less, but an hour, or at least a between, when childhood sense peaked, the apex of a little truth I return to, that cries my heart not from sentiment, but because everything that came after, nearly all of it, was a long arcing sound of manacles to the wheel, a choking, a consumption, a human drive to slave the stars themselves and make them squeal in capitulant song. I was never pretty after that. On this cracked desert floor tonight, I confess, I was never pretty. What I gave hard as any, give hard tonight and still, is music, many musics. I wage music against the slavers, and hold the stars will redeem what little truth I bear. What there is in magic comes to me when the world is close, very close, a purring wind, a crying, confessing music, your kiss at dawn as we lie together, two smiling, grasping souls, trying to parse out the pain in men and women, which they push away and revere and call God. We talked until dreams came and took us somewhere half forgetful, not to where the pain resolves and is gone, but a middle place where the hard things in this world give a little, and if we can figure up a tool or trick or utterance, perhaps we'll bring back a map or plan, tell one and another, know the magic as it knows us. Night Song. Looking out upon the night and seeing better than a god's possession, I wreck a mystery, a thrilling fury of lights, a brilliant assurance that men govern neither this world nor any other, that myths from open hands and dreams behind shut eyes are a little closer and still not very close at all, that whatever this messy coalescence, this seeming discordance of voices and phenomena, the story yet to be wholly revealed will ignore, perhaps explain, nothing. It's called Elemental Beings. There was laughter and argument over which beings were demonic and which simply impish. How you can tell, said the master smoothly, a hand coyly on the bare leg beside him, is whether they desert you when the rent is due. More laughter, more uneasy. You are waiting something prettier, perhaps? Silence. Most of us could not fly our way out of a daydream. Whether he devoured them later, then or later, is probably unimportant. It's actually poem 13 in the series. I just couldn't title it, so I just titled it 13. When they buried your voice, and I was afar, a stone and a paved patch of earth, you took what beauty translates worlds, and whether or not you still sing it, I know your music still plays on. This one's titled The Way is Disillusioned.
The Way is Disillusioned.
And years ago on a city bench, the man I sat with was sad. His woman was young and had finally fucked him over. I wanted to give him those words, the ones that heal, even undo. But there aren't any of those. I've looked. Healing comes as afterward, from wreckage, with too many memories crowding into bed, and mornings that need something and give little back. I sat with him and told dirty whore jokes because that's about all there is. Gave him my hand, pointed to the moon. The healing comes. It's dirty healing at best. Hunger's return again needs sating. The way is disillusion. There really are no words that undo. Victor.
Oh my god.
The spotlight turns.
Okay, let me see. What do I got here? I got all kinds of crap here. This is a fucking awesome book right here. Japanese death poems.
Oh my gosh.
This is I didn't realize there's a tradition that dates back an awful long time. And the introduction on this book is like 100 pages, and it's fucking, it's absolutely fascinating. Uh-huh. It goes on about the evolution of the haiku.
Right.
And the different forms that it's taken over time. And then, you know, into some proper haiku. And not all these are proper haiku. Some of them are written in an older style. And
yeah.
There was another form of haiku that was written as sort of public satire. It has a different name. Where, you know how you could do the 5-7-5?
Yeah.
Well, it was 5-7-5, and then there was two additional lines for 7-7. Mm. And then that's where groups of men would come together. The first person would write that first haiku. Then, like, that other person would write those next two lines, and then the other person would write another haiku where they would alternate.
Oh, right.
And sometimes they fell into the realm of public commentary, almost, or satire. Right. So some of the really good guys really knew how to play with words.
Yeah.
But, and some of this, you know, you kind of go, well, some of this is probably not quite true. But the tradition of the death poem was that a lot of these haiku poets, these Zen monks, and also these warrior monks, guys that had been in the army at one point in time, but then they fell into the monastery, mm-hmm. right? So they were kind of like, they'd given up their battle way, but right. they still have a little bit of the mentality there. Mm-hmm. They have a different sort of attack on perception.
Yeah.
And so when the Zen masters supposedly a lot of times knew when they were going to die, and then they would write basically, or be on their deathbed, and their students or their friends or family or whatever would write your death poem, right? And so this was like
oh my gosh,
that entire person's existence distilled down into one haiku.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
Oh my gosh, that is terrifying.
So it's like, I thought, wow, you might be able to really find some really neat shit in here.
Holy crap.
And then like the some of the warrior poets, right? This was a tradition too. Because you know the Japanese system.
I like that.
The Japanese system the Japanese system of honor and loyalty towards like their, you know, their little liege lords or their domain lords or whoever was intense into the death.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if that lord says, I want you to commit harikiri, I mean, that's what you did, right?
Wow.
And so a lot of these guys would go, these warriors would go into lost causes knowing they were going to die, right? And what's really great about this book, too, is it's just so full of factoids about Japanese culture. Because on some of them, it gives the poem, and then it tells about the man for a page and a half.
Uh-huh.
And they have some histories,
yeah.
But some of these warrior poets, there was this one. He'd been wounded in a gunfight in this like 1800s. It was part of the last of all that, really.
Yeah.
And knew he was going to go into a lost cause. You know, it's like his very good friend, the other general, had lost his sons. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like, so he'd been shot. They take him somewhere. Try to nurse his wounds to see if he can, you know, bring him back. But he was mortal.
Right.
And they found his death poem was on the inside of his armor in the back.
Oh.
He, like, basically pinned it to his back. So when they peeled him out, there was his poem.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. But supposedly, some of these Zen masters, and this was a sign of enlightenment,
mm-hmm.
Would literally die sitting in lotus.
Crossed legs?
Yeah, you know, sitting in meditation.
Uh-huh.
And that was considered, that was a true mark of an enlightened person.
Huh.
Because they knew, they were so in tune. And I thought about this for a minute one evening.
Uh-huh.
I thought, okay, because you know, a lot of these guys, they're 80, 90, and you know, this is a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you had to really disciplined your mind into understanding your body, I think if you were young and healthy, to try to turn off your autonomic system would probably be impossible, just because of that lizard mind back there.
Yeah,
yeah. No, dude, you're still good.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you were old and weak and accepting of that period, rather than and having that much discipline, and again, this is all speculation, that they might be able to do that.
Yeah.
I thought if your system was weak, and you felt like you were done, and I mean, could you basically go into your meditative state and shut down?
Sure.
And so maybe that's what happened with some of these guys. And again, you know, some of it could be just simply a legend. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, he died sitting upright, because it makes a prettier story. This is Billy Collins. He's the guy.
Oh, Billy Collins. Sure, I've heard of him.
He was the Poet Laureate of 2007.
Right, right.
And his style is just fucking awesome. Oh, let me find three.
He's kind of like, he's a little bit like Country Boy, but he's like really smart as hell Country Boy.
Right. And
is that right?
He seems to present this picture. He presents an image. And then right at the end, and what I really like about his style, he's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Right.
He's
entertaining that way, so his stuff sticks with you a little bit, because you go, huh. But then he'll take something and make kind of a funny picture, and then at the end of it, he'll twist it around and make it a little more poignant or a little bittersweet.
Yeah, he's got a definite groove.
Okay, and you know, I probably have read this one before. Oh, there's a. Oh, here, let me do Splitting Wood.
Okay.
Splitting Wood was. I liked this one a lot. Because he's working on multiple levels here. He's working with a imagery level, the reality of it, mm-hmm. and then some of the symbology and some of this other truth, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Called Splitting Wood. Better wet my whistle. Frost covered this decades ago, and frost will cover it again tonight, the leafy disarray of this woodland. Now thinned down to half its trees, but this morning I stand here sweating in a thin shirt as I split a stack of ash logs into firewood with two wedges, an axe, and a blue-headed maul. The pleasures here are well known, the feet planted wide, the silent and stoppable flow of the downswing, the coordination called hand-eye, because the hand achieves whatever conscipience whatever the conscupent eye desires. When it longs for a certain spot, which in this case is the slightest fissure visible at one end of the log, where the thin, insulating edge of the blade can gain entry, where the shape of its will can be done. I want to say there is nothing like the sudden opening of wood, but it is like so many other things, the stroke of axe like lightning, the bisection so perfect, the halves fall away from each other, as in a mirror, and hit the ground softly, like twins shot through the heart. And rarely, if the wood accepts the blade without conditions, the two pieces keep their balance in spite of the blow, remain stunned on the block as if they cannot believe their division, their sudden separateness. Still upright, still together, they wobble slightly, as two lovers, once secretly bound, might stand revealed, more naked than ever. The darkness inside the tree they share now instantly explodes to the blunt light of this clear November day. All of the inner twisting of the grain that held them blindly in their augmentation and contortion now rushed into this brightness as if by a shutter that once opened can never be closed.
Oh my gosh. That's good. That's good. That's good. You pretty much did everything you can do with that.
Okay, here. I've read this one before. I think this one was not too bad. It's called Purity, right? Another whistle wedding here. My favorite time to write is in the late afternoon, weekdays, particularly Wednesdays. This is how I go about it. I take a fresh pot of tea into my study and close the door. Then I remove my clothes and leave them in a pile, as if I had melted to death and my legacy consisted only of a white shirt, a pair of pants, and a pot of cold tea. Then I remove my flesh and hang it over the chair. I slide it off my bones like a silken garment. I do this so that what I write will be pure, completely rinsed of the carnal, uncontaminated by the preoccupations of the body. Finally, I remove each of my organs and arrange them on a small table near the window. I do not want to hear their ancient rhythms when I am trying to tap out my own drum beat. Now I sit down at the desk, ready to write. I am entirely pure, nothing but a skeleton at the typewriter. I should mention that sometimes I leave my penis on. I find it difficult to ignore this temptation. Then I am a skeleton with a penis at the typewriter. In this condition, I write extraordinary love poems, most of them exploiting the connection between sex and death. I am concentration itself. I exist in a universe where there is nothing but sex, death, and typewriting. After a spell of this, I remove my penis too. Then I am just skull and bones typing into the afternoon, with the absolute essentials, no flounces. Now I write only about death, most classical of themes in language light as air between my ribs. Now I write only about death, most classical of themes in language light as the air between my ribs. Afterwards, I reward myself by going for a drive at sunset. I replace my organs and slip back into my flesh and clothes. Then I back the car out of the garage and speed along woods on winding country roads, passing stone walls, farmhouses, and frozen ponds, all perfectly arranged like words in a famous sonnet.
Nice.
Isn't that fucking guy awesome?
Yeah. Wow.
In time of daffodils who know the goal of living is to grow, forgetting why, remember how. In time of lilacs who proclaim the aim of waking is to dream, remember so, forgetting seem. In time of roses, who amaze our now and here with paradise, forgetting if, remember yes. In time of all sweet things beyond whatever mind may comprehend, remember seek, forgetting find. And in a mystery to be, when time from time shall set us free, forgetting me, remember me. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I who have died am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and love and wings, and of the gay great happening illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any, lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you, now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. When God lets my body be, from each brave eye shall sprout a tree, fruit that dangles therefrom, the purpled world will dance upon, between my lips which did sing. A rose shall beget the spring, that maidens whom passion wastes will lay between their little breasts. My strong fingers beneath the snow, into strenuous birds shall go, my love walking in the grass. Their wings will touch with her face, and all the while shall my heart be with the bulge and nuzzle of the sea. So this is called Song. But weave the May, for you are in love and I am, to sing, my darling, while old worlds and young, big, little, and all worlds merely have the must to say, and the wind to do is exactly theirs, dull worlds or keen, big, little, and all. But lose or win, come heaven, come hell, precisely ours is the now to grow. It's love by whom, my beautiful friend, the gift to live is without until. But pitiful, they've big and little and all, no power beyond the trick to seem. Their joys turn woes, and right goes wrong. Dim worlds or bright, big, little and all. Whereas, my sweet, our summer and fall, and in winter our spring is the yes of yes. Love was and shall be this only truth, a dream of a deed born not to die, but worlds are made of hello and goodbye, glad sorry are both, big, little, and all. My love is building a building around you, a frail, slippery house, a strong, fragile house, beginning at the singular beginning of your smile. A skillful, uncouth prison, a precise, clumsy prison, building that and this into thus, around the reckless magic of your mouth. My love is building a magic, a discreet tower of magic, and as I guess, when Farmer Death, whom fairies hate, shall crumble the mouthflower fleet, he'll not my tower, laborious casual, where the surrounded smile hangs breathless. Sometimes I'm alive because with me her alert tree-like body sleeps, which I will feel slowly sharpening, becoming distinct with love slowly, who in my shoulder sink sweetly teeth until we shall attain the spring-smelling, intense, large, together-colored instant, the moment pleasantly frightful when her mouth suddenly rising wholly begins with mine fiercely to fool, and from my thighs which shrug and pant, a murdering rain leapingly reaches the upward singular deepest flower which she carries in a gesture of her hips. Seeker of truth, follow no path, all paths lead where truth is here. Seeker of truth, follow no path, all paths lead where truth is here. I say that on my walk home from work sometimes, just over and over again. Seeker of truth, follow no path, all paths lead where truth is here.
That's good.
It's short, and it's my mantra. I don't know what it means, and I like it, but like when I walk home by myself, on the one day that I walk home by myself, mm-hmm. I just say it to myself over and over again.
It's a grounding exercise.
Yeah.
And it's always good to have some of those.
Yeah.
So this is a Dar Williams song that she played that I had never heard, and I would like us all to close our eyes and listen, because it's very pretty. And Raymond, you've heard it, but, you know.
I don't mind hearing it again.
And then the other song is one that you got me hooked on, and it would just be nice to listen to right now. So.
Absolutely.
Anyway, this is called If I Wrote You.
Never thought you were the letter writing type. So now I see the words you chose, the way you write. So I started to write back about the trees and the snow. And I saw a bird come say what it was, but I thought you would know. You always surprised me. If I wrote you, if I wrote you, you would know me, and you would not write me again. And when the spring came and flooded all the streams, it's like how you got the night you told me all your dreams. And when the barn roof sagged after an icy bound, it's like how you shrugged when you knew the truth was the only way out. But not the only way. If I wrote you, if I wrote you, you would know me, you would not write me again. Thought the world needed love and a steady hand, so I'm steady now. Yeah. I'm so happy.
when I was writing all those poems at coffee time, I was listening to Bill Distill's new album that just come out.
And then you played it for me Friday morning.
Right, and there was one song that just, yeah, I played like 30 times
we
in a row.
We played
this
song 100 times. It's beautiful. Yeah. It's amazing. Are you ready? It's called Things Fall Apart.
Thank you.
So this is called Psychedelic Dream 4. I'm in bed holding a sack of sand. It is a precious thing. I'm afraid. I'm holding it and now I wake up. I am dreaming that I'm awake and telling my lover about the dream of holding the precious sack of sand. She listens. I wake but do not, and where's the sack? I panic and seem to feel it again in my hands, but is it leaking? Am I losing it? Awake this time? Seems so. The sweat, the bed lamp, your movements to rise. How do I hold the sack now, now that I know it? Almost sounds like Billy Collins.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. So, I like, you know, whatever. All right, this one's a good one. So there's this guy downtown Portland that Cassie and I both seen different times. He's a big belly guy, walks around with a doll.
It's like a snowman doll.
Like a snowman doll. He's got a little hat on, and
that's so his thing.
What's that?
Is he homeless?
I don't think he's homeless, but I think he's...
He might live in a halfway house or something.
He's gifted.
Yeah. But, I mean, I just happened to run into him one day. I just happened to see him, and he was standing at, like, a corner, and I kind of hid because I just wanted to watch him. I didn't want to make him feel uncomfortable. I just wanted to check him out. So people like that interest me. I often think I'm just this side of snowman street corner. One wrong move, and... There you go. I combine that with a dream I had about a prison planet called Prison Planet Blues. When the fat man with the blue doll who looked like him said it, of course nobody listened. He held his street corner day after day and spoke in deep warning, nothing to it. Then the first ships appeared overhead in late summer, silently. He tried to explain, but no, there was something else. We expected something else. We want something else. We deserve something else. He tried to say, smoking his cigarettes through their filters, holding his companion day after day. He said, what if you are right? What if the universe is created by men? What if they'd been growing you for resources? What if the doubt slivered into consciousness and its furious terror of death could have been removed by pulling off your pinky nail and bleeding through to original programming? What life was before we were marked for cultivation? He shakes his head. He looks at his doll. Looks around his street corner. Nothing yet. No.
That was fun.
Yeah. That was... Yeah. Okay, so the next one is called Secret. And as Cassie said, this is where things begin to get weird. But then you might be me too? What of me I do not know, far, alive, what are you? You don't look like me, you don't do what I do. If we connect by dream, and it holds, there will be more to say, maybe to sing between us. Sing. Do you sing? Will you sing to me in dreams? Okay, so I was grooving on that, and every couple of poems I came back to it. This is If Not Alone. Could I be walking around tonight as someone else too? That is, while I sit here, am I also someone else, someone else, somewhere else? Who could that be? Who would you be? What is the what to say to you to bring you back in dreams? And then to veer away from that theme for a moment, this is called Hidden Fifth. How to move like the universe moves, that is, flowing, flowering, evolving, undulating, and keep moving like the universe moves, shifting, dancing, wind on grass, a smiling woman, closed eyes in her passion, and not stop moving ever again, for dreams are not discontinuous. They resume, and the music never ends. The universe never ends. Dance of dreaming forever, never ends, never ends. Two or three. If you were two or three, meeting me in dreams, teaching me new singing, are there other kinds of songs sung alone and in concert both? I would near you, I would learn, if there was a way, an instruction, and if you were two or three, why not more? Back to the... I had this vision of a person out there who's also me. And I was just... All right. Well, we're going to have a conversation here in my notebook.
Your doppelganger.
I don't know. Or two or three or more. This is a business. Other ways to watch a pine wave in rainy breeze, or a strange girl in a long hat smiling down a forgotten autumn's path. Other ways to work it than fall stumbling sucker to the guitars again and again and again. Could see the world as a feed bag and try to build a 1,000-foot-high golden tit. All possibilities and 1,000 others for slinging ass and making way. But maybe there's only some years and the sound doors make closing. Doors closing and the hunger that everything matters. Medicine for the past. I cannot stop you from doing that, or suffering that, or again in a new way, and how you are alone tonight, and it hurts. You'll drink hard, or years later you will eat a good high, and some comfort to be found. But I can say that your pen is still moving tonight, this poem brother to the one you are writing, like a glowing motherfucker, to win that one back, or summon the next, brothers to you and your poem, and here's our hope, together, that other brother poems will join our praise for many years hence. Love song to Raymond. And finally, Grind is the last poem in the series. To one day, one night, one hour, grind this world true. Heart open, my face full in the light, grind it true. My truth, the world's truth, grinding. And what might come, and what is coming. Cassie's read Jude poems before. Oh, you know Jude. She's the one at Spirit Plants.
Jude girl.
I seem to often read her poems, but there was one in particular that I really liked.
She's so cool.
She's still over there? She's still doing that thing?
The
Israel?
Yeah. Yeah. She's married. She's got a few kids. She teaches.
So fucking hardcore.
Yeah, she comes back every once in a while, every, I don't know, 6 months a year, she comes back and visits her kin, Canada, and down here, and she gets a dose of, you know, America, and then she goes back to her life.
Yeah, boy, that's probably like, it's probably quite a shocker coming back to the States.
Yeah, yeah. She's a sweetheart.
So there's four in here, and I want to read two.
Okay.
They're short. First one is called 1 September. In rush, a sweeping watermark, one lone shard, one lone remnant. We lived here long ago, we barefoot, silly artists, creating heavenly earthenware, all for one, till we all fell down. One large rush swept away 1 September, while water weeps, tears become tides, and the cycle goes on. Mm. And then this one is called In an Age of Antimatter. In an age of antimatter, doesn't matter, no worries, we worry. We sit in quasi-meditation or not, to be in Zen totality or not. How little it takes to fill our void, yet void is so lusciously empty. Lots of space between the ears, rattling or revolving, been taught to focus, been trained to unfocus. Colliding entities one-on-one doesn't matter much. We worry, no worries. With luck pops a poem, a song, a moment, a cocoon of laughter, twirling like the steam of a fingen, bubbling liquid. From cup to cup, one-on-one, we cease to worry, we miss nothing, we miss it all. The mist carries our mind to sweet reveries, we see nothing, we see it all.
I'm going to read a letter I wrote to President Obama.
Oh, sure.
It's only 2 pages, but I figured it was time to write him a letter.
Third one I've written.
I first started writing to representatives of Patty Murray up in Washington, and then wrote to Kennedy, which you always like to rag me about, and then I've written Obama 3 times. But I haven't sent this one yet, but I will. Dear President Obama, this is my 3rd letter to you, but the first time since you've been President of these United States. I wrote to you in June 2008 while you were a U.S. Senator from Illinois campaigning for President, and again last December when you'd won the office but not yet been sworn in. So in both instances, I was anticipating rather than considering your work as President. I say this as prelude to this letter, which does this considering. First of all, let me congratulate you on being awarded the 2009 Nobel Peace Prize. I would say I was surprised without being shocked. It is becoming clear to me that the world outside the U.S. treasures you in a way Americans, many, do not. Your being about as far from George W. Bush as imaginably possible alone is enough to give you great honors.
Yeah. You're the Peace Prize.
Pretty much just for being him.
Okay.
Americans, on the other hand, evaluate you too minutely to step back for the larger view. Some fear you will do too much. More fear you will not do enough. I find myself drawn to sports teams' analogies when thinking about your style of governance. You clearly recognize 2 things. You were not made king, and your time in the office is definably finite, 8 years at most. You know the twined political and corporate and media bureaucracies of Washington and the nation as a whole, predated your election, and will continue should you govern every day from January 20th, 2009 to January 20th, 2017. It's how it is. So the clock is ticking, but it's early. Time enough to try some things. Start accruing some points and momentum. Of course, arriving to a playing field bloodied and gouged as George W. Bush left it throws a kind of desperate spin on the game right off. So to advance the sports metaphor, maybe leave it too, we're in a playoff series, best of 7, once heavily favored, but now down 3-1. Time to panic? No, not your style. Time to game plan. Call out weaknesses, clarify priorities, figure strategies. You made promises, now every hand is out. Your opponents are going to crowd the line, play dirty, do whatever. There are always fat cat motherfuckers who are doing nicely, slurping up their share of blood profits in the soft shadows of quasi-legality. Don't like a diminished amount of slurp. I like that he used the word motherfucker in a letter to the president.
Well, you know, Michelle Obama's brother is one of the Blazers.
Oh, isn't that funny?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he's got all kinds of pressure on him, and the, you know, he's like, because he's a Blazer, or he's in the basketball team, and then you know his sister's married to the president, you know. So there was an interview of him on the NPR the other day. He's like tight.
Yeah. I bet. Call out weaknesses. The country is mostly broke, angry, sick of war, despising Republicans, and none too kinning up to Democrats. In truth. Your fresh blood, an order, a visionary, cool and wicked intelligent. Clarify priorities, easy. You call out the broken healthcare system as crippling the nation's economy and a moral abomination. This focuses the media chatter and is, while a risky issue to tackle first, one whose tricky navigation to success will keep the bar set high and rack up the points. What will come after? No doubts here. Civil rights legislation, gay rights, drug policy revision, stem cell research, environmental policy. All important, all wait, but their successes hinge on health care. That's the first big score. Overseas, the path is clear. American presidents do more as they will and can on the world stage. So, talks with Iran, North Korea, Russia, talks with Israel and Palestine, renewal of commitment to diplomacy in the United Nations. I believe you will do a lot more in time. But I believe you will do a lot more in time, that you've had to deal with the great wounded beast. This nation is foremost, and you are and you will. Iraq will be out in 2012. Afghanistan, you'll be stuck with that one for a while because withdrawal is not so simple. But I would estimate that you have no taste for perpetual war and occupation, nor will you abandon a nation in suffering, in part by the U.S.'s doing. My guess is the answers will come slowly, like with the health care domestically. You've been in office about 10 months, 10 out of a possible 96. What I've seen in that time is a man settling into his job while having to perform it at the highest level. You are not a miracle worker, yet you've changed a great deal already. No one was talking about serious health care reform a year ago, as though it would happen anytime soon. Diplomatic talks with Iran were inconceivable. A siege mentality had consumed the world, a constant wondering where the lunatic monster head in D.C. would lurchily turn its rabid, blurry, red-eyed gaze next. What was left for Bush to fuck up? He leaves office, you arrive, a society with little patience waits about 5 minutes before complaining. The heart of what I want to say to you right now is this. You will never bear the power or influence again that you are accumulating now and will have for the next 2 years or so. Don't save it. Power does not keep. The fire you're raising now, the allies you're making, the strategies for working with Congress, handling the media, and so on, is a conjuration that will go so far and eventually spend out. Power and fire are both like that. For a while, you will have to play with practically breathless perfection and hope or pray the universe or some equal potency is mostly on your side. So I say this, play it through. Hesitate less often until not at all. There's a moment in playing the great games, in making the great works of art, in conceiving the greatest thoughts of science and philosophy and learning, a moment when impediments fall aside and the way opens clear. You are nearing that point, Mr. President Barack, where trust is all, action is all. You will no longer make the moves will make you. That's what I see now and foresee for you as forthcoming. A lot of work, a lot of wrangling. Just remember, my friend, it's not that your best fire won't spend out. It's how well you wield it while it is in your hands. Play it artless, play it humble, play it like you can't lose. Peace. Raymond Seward.